Stay tuned after the show for a message from Chevron.
'Twas the day before Friday when all through the town, reporters were scrambling for transition news to come out. When all of the sudden, texts all just came in. First Regan, then Holland, huge progressive wins. And so on our podcast, before ending the year, Ben LaFabe and Zach Coleman will both be right here. But fear not, don't worry, Alex Yen joins us too. And I'm Anthony Adragna. We will start in a few.
We now have a pick, President-elect Joe Biden, making his decision on his interior secretary. Tell me more about it.
Isn't it wild, though? The 1 hour I'm not on my phone since probably 2019, and that's exactly when two of the biggest stories we've been following during the transition break.
A new barrier broken here with Congresswoman Deb Haaland of New Mexico as his choice to lead the Interior Department.
On the latest selection to Joe Biden's cabinet, the president-elect has tapped Michael Regan to lead the Environmental Protection Agency.
On Thursday afternoon, we learned of two more Biden picks for his incoming administration. New Mexico Congresswoman Deb Haaland is going to be the nominee to lead the Interior Department, while North Carolina regulator Michael Regan is the pick to lead the Environmental Protection Agency. Today, Politico's Zach Coleman, Alex Guillen, and Ben LaFabe walk us through the last two major environmental cabinet nominees. It's Friday, December 18th. On Haaland in particular, there's been a very visible pressure campaign from outside groups to get her picked. Her selection is obviously historic. If confirmed, she'd be the first Native American cabinet secretary in history, which is pretty astounding. Do you think that that pressure campaign proved decisive in her getting the pick, or what influence did it have on the process?
I actually was talking to activists back in early November who flat out told me, yeah, we haven't talked to anyone in the Biden campaign. We don't know whether they like her, but we're just going to start working the press and get her name out there. So, you know, she had a lot of supporters. It's not like she's unqualified. She's very qualified. She knows the issues. She has connections out west. She has connections to a big portion of the Democratic base.
I heard one person kind of describe Haaland's nomination as a mix of good politics and good policy. Basically that she was a good pick as far as policy. She's been very strong on conservation. She signed on to the 30 by 30 plan that was out there a little bit to, you know, put 30% of the American landmass under, you know, protection by 2030. But it was also seen as like Dems would be able to nominate her, and then they'd be basically daring the GOP to look like, as this person put it, troglodytes to vote against her.
And Zach, maybe you can weigh in on this and then you can jump if you need to. But the fact that Haaland, you know, original co-sponsor of the Green New Deal, she led this 30 by 30 resolution. I would argue she's one of, if not the most progressive picks to date.
Yes, she totally is. I just retweeted our colleague Laura Barone Lopez, who actually started her DC reporting career covering environment, and she tweeted, arguably the biggest win for progressives in the cabinet picks so far. And, you know, that I'll take Laura's word for it. I mean, she covers Congress and she covers the campaigns, and this is a huge win for progressives. They're really elated by this.
Anything else you need to add, Zach, before you jump?
I gotta go. So
okay. Bye, Zach.
Bye.
So, Alex, I wonder if we can dig down a little bit deeper in the selection of Michael Regan. What should people know about him? I don't think he's a familiar name to many in D.C. at this point.
No, he's not a big name in D.C. at the moment. He will be soon, but just as an introduction to Michael Regan, he actually spent the first 10 years of his career working at EPA in career positions in the air office. So he has actually some extensive experience at the agency that surely will be helpful as he's trying to navigate the bureaucracy. He then went on to spend about 8 years at the Environmental Defense Fund, where he ran a number of their initiatives. And then 4 years ago, of course, North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper picked him to run DEQ in North Carolina, which is where he's been ever since. So he actually has quite a bit to draw on. And notably, you know, he's doing all this. He's only 44 years old, so very accomplished for that age especially.
Alex, what do you think makes a good EPA administrator?
What makes a good EPA administrator? In my experience, I found it's the ones who send me emails and text messages about what they're doing behind the scenes.
The one who picks up when I call.
But actually, one thing that I think a lot of people don't quite realize about EPA is just how expansive and extensive the agency is. A lot of people come into it with into these political jobs with having been focused on one particular area, like air or water or land contamination. And ultimately, you have to be able to crack the whip on all of those.
Alex, what should people know about Brenda Mallory, who is the pick to lead the White House Council on Environmental Quality?
Yeah, Brenda Mallory, she most recently is coming from the Southern Environmental Law Center. So a lot of folks are citing that as giving her good insight into environmental justice issues. She'll be running CEQ at the White House. That's sort of a broad and potentially nebulous position. You'll find a lot of people at the White House don't really understand what CEQ's exact role is. It is still an important position. One area that'll be specifically up to her to address will be the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. So she's very likely to be revisiting that and probably reissuing a new rule or new guidance in the next couple of years.
Also,
hackers accessed unclassified networks at the Department of Energy, responsible for maintaining America's nuclear weapons stockpile.
Yesterday, my colleagues Natasha Bertrand and Eric Wolf reported that hackers accessed the networks of the Energy Department and of the National Nuclear Security Administration.
They say that at this point, the investigation has found that the malware has been isolated to business networks only and has not actually impacted the mission essential national security functions of the department.
The breach of the agency that maintains the U.S. nuclear weapons stockpile is related to the massive espionage operation that has affected at least half a dozen federal agencies. The officials at both agencies say they found suspicious activity in networks belonging to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, as well as Sandia and Los Alamos National Laboratories in New Mexico and Washington. In the case of FERC, officials say they have evidence of highly malicious activity, although they did not elaborate on the kind of activity.
Remember, the Russians still have not been directly blamed by the U.S. government for this attack.
While the federal government continues to study the damage caused by the breach, it has not yet pointed the finger at who is responsible for the attack. But cybersecurity experts have said the activity bears the hallmarks of Russia's intelligence services. Before we go, I just wanted to let you know that Politico Energy is going to be off for the holidays starting next week. We'll be bringing back some of our favorite episodes from the year over the next couple of days, and we'll be coming back with more news on energy, the environment, and the transition in January. Subscribe to Politico Energy wherever you listen, and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you want more energy news in your inbox, subscribe to our newsletter at politico.com/morningenergy. Carlos Prieto is our producer. Our senior producer is Jenny Ahmet. And our executive producer is Irene Noguchi. Our editor is Matt Daly. And on the show this week,
Alex Guillen,
Ben LaFave,
Zach Coleman,
Tyler Pager,
Sam Mintz.
I'm Anthony Adragna. Thanks for listening and happy holidays.
It's only human to want to build a better future for all. Chevron is working together with women and minority-owned businesses, spending $4 billion since 2014. Because valuable ideas only come when you value everyone. Learn more at chevron.com.